Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. By the way, if you were interested in that Chinese American newspaper series and that whole series with the Chinese American newspaper segment and the whole series with the Feed in Two Worlds immigration program and guests, we have a link to the Feed in Two Worlds podcast on our Brian Lehrer Show page, WNYC.org. Now, some people collect stamps or cat figurines. My next guest collects languages. Not to speak them necessarily, but to learn their quirks and classes, moods and voices, cases and declensions, all the little differences that speak to the diversity and oddity of human development as much as anything in National Geographic. Elizabeth Little is a writer and editor living in Queens who has compiled a kind of travel guide to world languages in an amazing new book called Biting the Wax Tadpole, Confessions of a Language Fanatic. She joins me now. Thanks very much for coming in. Hi there.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Maybe in Queens these days you need to understand a lot of languages just to walk down the street.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, in my neighborhood alone, there's Turkish, Romanian, Spanish, Arabic. It's a really fascinating place to live, particularly if you're interested in language.
The title of your book, Biting the Wax Tadpole, that speaks to some of the difficulty in moving from one language to the other, in this case, English to Mandarin?
It does. One of the interesting things about Mandarin is that it uses characters for the written language, and each character has not only a sound associated with it, but also a meaning, which means that sometimes when you have literal translations of the transliterations of Western names, you get something really interesting. So when Coca-Cola introduced its product to China in the 1920s, it took them a while to come up with sort of a great transliteration. And the one they eventually settled on is lovely. It translates literally as sort of deliciousness or happiness in the mouth. But before that, before they had their official name, shopkeepers were doing their own thing. And one of the most popular transliterations translated literally as bite the wax tadpole.
Was that good or bad for sales?
Well, the interesting thing is that for native Chinese speakers, that sort of the inference of in the meaning really doesn't matter because there are these different characters that are used for transliteration. So they would just read it as a name. But for Americans and English speakers, of course, it's very funny.
How many languages do you speak?
Well, speak well is, I would say French, Italian, Chinese, and then I have a reading knowledge and mostly useless reading knowledge of ancient Greek and classical Chinese as well.
And it's not just about the words, right? Because you opened with a tale of traveling in China, which highlighted one of the major differences between English and Mandarin, and its tone more than content.
Exactly. It's not just, you know, learning the words and what they mean, but learning to pronounce them in a way that's comprehensible. And I had a huge problem in China when I first went there because Mandarin has four main tones. And so you can have the syllable ma, which can mean horse or mother or hemp or skull, depending on whether or not you say it. Ma, 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 ma. All four of those words mean separate things. And so for English speakers, that's obviously a big hurdle.
What about Mandarin speakers learning English?
Well, I think it's actually easier to go from Mandarin to English in that respect because you don't have to worry about tone so much. Obviously, there are other sort of phonological difficulties, though.
Let's open up the phones for people who are at least bilingual, let's say. You could be trilingual, quadrilingual, whatever. But if you're at least bilingual, I wonder if you have any examples of what you can't say in English or what you can't say in your other language, or maybe some examples like this, where it's not just the words, but the tone or the inflection that make it get lost, or maybe some things get found in translation. Mm-hmm. Call us at 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692 for Elizabeth Little, author of Biting the Wax Tadpole, Confessions of a Language Fanatic. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692, or post a comment or your story at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. Did these differences in language translate into other cultural differences? For example, there was an article in the New York Sun just this morning about a new American dialect of Spanish. It uses more pronouns than traditional Spanish. So in that example, do you think the use of pronouns might mean something about being Americanized?
I think it means something about being Americanized in that you're in a linguistic environment where pronouns are much more heavily used than they are in sort of traditional Spanish. Because as most people probably know, there in English we'll only have sort of usually two forms of a verb, one for like he says and I say. But in Spanish, there are six separate forms, so you can drop pronouns, and people still know what you're talking about. But what's interesting is in New York, there are so many different dialects of Spanish that are all sort of intermingling on a regular basis that they all seem to be growing and borrowing not from just from each other, but also sort of from English. And so this huge rise that researchers are seeing in the use of pronouns in New York City Spanish is a real indication that there's a lot more assimilation going on than people might realize.
And when you say assimilation, is it just linguistic, or does it reflect something about our culture that we would use more pronouns?
I'm not sure if there's a link between how many pronouns we use and for instance, what our relationship is to other people.
Yeah.
But it's definitely indicating, not necessarily because it's pronouns, but because there's this change, that the language, the foreign, you know, non-English language communities in New York are definitely interacting heavily with other language communities, which I think a lot of people might sort of underestimate the widespread sort of nature of that.
Peter in Morristown, you're on WNYC. Yeah. Hi, Peter.
Hi, good morning. Hi, I'm a native Hungarian speaker, and I've also learned Chinese. And I noticed that in both languages, there's no personal pronoun of he or she in the language. It's all done by knowing the context. And the other observation that I've learning Chinese is that the grammar is much simpler than English. There's no past, present, and future, particularly no verb conjugation. So that makes it far easier than English to learn for English speakers than a Chinese speaker trying to learn English.
Thank you. You agree?
Yeah, absolutely. That's one of the great things about Chinese when I started studying was that you don't have to memorize verb conjugations. And for anyone who studied a Romance language and suffered through French verbs, that's incredibly refreshing.
How do you communicate time if you don't have tenses?
Well, there's something called aspect, which indicates whether or not an action is completed or ongoing. And then, of course, there's context. So you can say, tomorrow I go to the store, which is the same thing as saying, tomorrow I will go. So even though there aren't proper verb tenses, it's still equally expressive as English. It just has to find other ways around it.
Peter, thank you. And Michael in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC with Elizabeth Little. Hi.
Oh, hi. I just have a couple of thoughts. These are related to Swahili, actually, though I've also studied Chinese, Arabic, and some other languages. And there's an example. For example, when I was there teaching school in the 60s, and I would go to the post office, and they would my mail hadn't come yet, and they would say, Badu, Badu. Which kind of, telling me it's not there yet. And then I'd talk to some older man, and we would be joking around in Swahili, and he would say, oh, Badu Kijana, which basically means I'm still a young man. And I was confused, how can the word be I'm still a young man, and yet my mail hasn't come yet? And I realized ultimately that Badu means something like yet. So, like, it is yet to come, and I am yet a young man. And that's one of those funny things that just doesn't translate very well.
Yeah, exactly. That's one of the wonderful things about different languages is learning the sort of those little words that add, real nuance to everything that you say and mean, and the ways that they can be used in two situations that could seem seemingly disparate.
Now, you call Swahili in your book the metric system of languages.
Swahili is an incredibly fascinating language, and all of the sort of related Bantu languages, in that they have this great system of sort of prefixes, where instead of what we have in sort of the French or Spanish or Romance languages with gender, where you have masculine and feminine and sometimes neuter, Swahili has a much more complicated system of noun class, where you have to use different prefixes for, I would say about 10 or so different classes of nouns, which at first can seem really intimidating. But you add those to verbs and to adjectives, so you get this wonderful sort of really alliterative, beautiful, lyrical language.
Paige in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hello, Paige.
Hi it's interesting that you're talking because Badu is about the only word I speak, but I also speak Indonesian, which is very similar to Swahili, in that it's contrived and has prefixes. But I find that there are several words in Indonesian that I just don't have good counterparts for in English. For instance, chocok, where it kind of means things meet up or match together well. And, you know, if I'm trying to fit my car into a parking spot in English, I would say, oh, is it going to fit? I don't know. It's kind of tight. Whereas in Indonesian, I say, oh, yeah, there's a chocok. Yeah, I'm going to slide right
through. That's good.
That's wonderful. I mean, and that's my favorite parts of language are the things that don't necessarily have single words that match up in English, but nonetheless, we can all understand them. It's just you sometimes need a wonderful analogy about parking in order to explain it.
Elizabeth Little, my guest on WNYC, who is the author of Biting the Wax Tadpole, Confessions of a Language Fanatic. You know, one of the things I learned from your book is a possible reason for nouns having a gender in Romance languages like French and Italian. It may have its roots in the naming of animate and inanimate objects.
Mm-hmm. Sort of what the linguistic theory is that way, way back in the day when everyone was speaking Indo-European, which is considered to be sort of the distant parent language of all those Romance languages, instead of separating nouns out into two groups that we've decided to call masculine and feminine, there might have been different ways of dealing with nouns that dealt with animate objects and inanimate objects. And you find this in other languages as well, and not just animate and inanimate, but sometimes rational and irrational, which means humans and people get one sort of linguistic treatment, and then everything else gets another.
So are males the rational and females the irrational? I mean, Pythagoras, you tell us, just assigned male and female to the two categories of nouns that existed.
Right, right. When Pythagoras was back in ancient Greece and studying grammar for the first time, he noticed that Greek has sort of three sets of nouns. And he was like, I'll call them, you know, masculine, feminine, and neuter. Why not? And then he got really upset when he realized that things like anger and, I think, war helmet were feminine because that sort of offended his sensibilities.
Chris on Staten Island. You're on WNYC. Hi, Chris.
Hi, good morning. Love your show.
Thank you.
Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi.
I find this conversation fascinating because I've experienced a lot of this in my travels to Italy. My father was born there, and I speak, I'm not entirely fluent, but I speak pretty well. A lot of it's the dialect that is spoken in Calabria. And there are many words that we use in English that mean multiple things to us, like room, for example. And this is the example I'm going to use, is my wife and I were over there, and my relatives were plying us with all this delicious food, and then the dessert comes out, and we're all absolutely stuffed. But, you know, my cousin Gilda makes a wonderful tiramisu, and my wife Gina said in Italian, she said, "Facero camera," which is, to her, meant I will make room in my belly to eat the tiramisu. And no one really understood what she was trying to say. And then when I translated that she wants to make space, you know, tried to further explain that she wants to make space in her stomach so that she can eat more food, we all got a really jolly laugh at the whole thing.
And there's no way to say that in English. That's a good story.
Right.
Let's take a couple other stories real quick. Gopal in Huntington, you're on WNYC. Hi there.
Oh, hi. Hi, Elizabeth. Hi. I'm from South India, and I speak at least two languages in South India, in addition to Hindi, which is a North Indian language, in addition to English, of course.
And you are Tamil, so, I understand?
Yeah, I'm Tamil, yes. Yeah. I speak Tamil and Kannada. Kannada is a language neighboring to Tamil state within India, South India. And I speak Hindi, which is widely used all over northern part. Half the population speak Hindi. And so the one thing I notice is there's supposed to be two families of languages, one based in Sanskrit, one based in Dravidian language called Tamil, about which I'm going to talk now. So here there is a form like, there is no verb form like am or are or is in Tamil. But all the other languages are derived from Sanskrit, have a similar format, something comparable to what is there in English. Mm.
How do you express that? The equivalent of that to be verb, am, are.
So what happens is, for example, is I am going to the market. In Tamil, you say, naan kadaikku pogiren. Naan is I. Pogiren is a verb which says that I am going. So if you are going to the market, I would say you are going to the market. Ni kadaikku pogirai. So po is a verb which says going. So the different forms of the verb is used to mention.
I see that to express that activity. All right, thank you for that. Lee in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Lee.
Hi, I'm Mandarin Chinese speaker. I found something in Chinese I just cannot say in English, at least not easily. And since your guest speaks Mandarin Chinese, the word is 地几, literally number which. Say if I ask you which president was Lincoln, and you say the 16th, but it sounds pretty weird question. Or if I ask you which city is Chicago, and you would know the answer would be the third largest in population. So how do you say a DZ in English?
I'm sorry, I'm having trouble hearing what you're saying. You mean, how do you say, if you're saying the third in Mandarin, or if you're saying...
If you ask a question, number which.
Like DE. Ask,
yeah, DE.
Yeah. The number which.
Right.
Right. And we just have 15 seconds left, so you'll have to do the best you can with this.
Well, I mean, DE is sort of an ordinal number which would indicate like first or second. And it is the same sort of translation in English as adding a TH sort of to the number, as far as I'm aware. But Mandarin is very complex and very varied, so it's possible that...
You know what? We have somebody waiting who wants to talk about different tones, pitches in Thai compared to English, different between English, and American English. So I think you're going to have to come back and do a part two sometime.